Hi, everybody. Couple of good guests on our Saturday podcast today. Chris Mannix will join us later. The truth about what's happening in the bubble in NBA land in Orlando. But first, somebody we couldn't bring on very regularly for years because he was at another place, and now he's a free agent. Our friend Phil Steele, philsteele.com. He writes the College Football Preview, 22 straight years, the most accurate college football Bible there is. By the way, it's out now, 350 full-color pages, stats, trends, angles, returning starters, forecasts. It's only $19.99. I got one or two sent to my house. I'm gobbling it up, and I'll keep it all season long and go back to it. So, Phil, let's start with this. One of the things I've always looked at, and it's always been something, is somebody that is a football gambler. In college, week to week, I think it's a hard sport to bet, but I do like futures. Give me a couple of teams, Phil, that through your research you feel are better than even the wise guys in Vegas think, that you think could really be surprise teams.
Let me give you a couple of them, Colin, and I'll start with Miami of Florida. You know, Miami's coming off a 6-win season last year, wasn't very good at the quarterback position, and they got an instant upgrade there, adding De'Ara King from Houston. De'Ara King had 36 touchdowns passing, 14 touchdowns running 2 years ago at Houston, despite missing two games. Well, I love this guy, and I think he gives him an instant upgrade there. And then you look at him defensively. Gregory Rousseau is a redshirt freshman, had 15.5 sacks last year. They added in Quincy Roche, a defensive end from Temple, an All-American Conference Defensive Player of the Year, 13.5 sacks. Those are your bookend defensive ends Miami's got, as well as the rest of the defense basically coming back. This is a loaded Miami team, and the number's extremely low on them. I like Miami to top their total. And then the second one would be Texas A&M. And talking to Coach Jimbo Fisher last year, two things really stuck out to me, Colin. First of all, the lack of seniors on the squad. They only had four or five seniors on the entire team. And the second was their schedule. They took on number one ranked Clemson, number one ranked Alabama, number one ranked LSU, number four Georgia, number eight Auburn. And I was talking to Coach Fisher, and I said, Coach, I'm going to put you on my national cover next year. Well, next year's here. The schedule's a lot lighter, and as opposed to playing three number one teams, they may only play two top ten teams. Wow. And they've got 17 returning starters, including Kellamonda QB. So they're a loaded team, and they're going to be a much different team this year. But I think a lot of folks look at that five losses from last year and peg them there. I think that they're going to be Alabama's prime contender in the West.
Okay, so the Miami Hurricanes and the Aggies from Texas A&M from the very perceptive Phil Steele. Now give me a couple of teams that maybe the public will bet the over. The public sees them, but you have real questions.
I would have to start maybe with Navy. I'm not sure what the preseason total is on Navy, but they lose a pretty good quarterback this year. And remember, just 2 years ago, they were coming off a 3-win season. Last year, they had a double-digit win season. Malcolm Perry was the difference, and Malcolm Perry is gone this year. They're going to have to replace him. I think that's going to be a little tough for them this year. And then also Air Force. Air Force is another team coming off an 11-win season. Talking to Coach Calhoun, he's very concerned about the experience level on this year's squad. And their quarterback, Donald Hammond, is probably not going to play this year. So you add all that up, and I think Air Force may be poised to take a step back. And then probably my poster boy for this year, Colin, and it's new head coach, inexperienced team. I think those teams are going to struggle this year. Michigan State's coming off three straight bowl games. Now they've got a brand new head coach who didn't get signed until February. Remember the fiasco they went through after D'Antonio stepped down late? And then Mel Tucker comes in. He did not have a single spring practice, only has 10 returning starters coming back this year.
Wow.
So it's an inexperienced team. No spring practice, didn't even sign the freshman class. He hasn't even seen these kids on the field. I think Michigan State takes a step back, has a losing year this year.
What do we make right now this morning of the Michigan football program? Now, Harbaugh's highly polarizing. Phil Steele joining us. I have supported him saying, listen, outside of Clemson and Bama, who the hell is beating Ohio State? So I have supported him, and I do think the program is significantly better today than the last year of Brady Hoke. Where do you hold them in regard this year and the program overall?
Yeah, this year I think they're going to take a little step back. I don't know if they're capable of contending with Ohio State. I really thought their window last year was last year, Colin, their window to win the Big Ten because they got them at home. There's a lot of question marks with Ohio State heading into the year with the new head coach. You thought if Michigan's ever going to beat Ohio State, it's going to be this year. They didn't get it done. This year they only have 11 returning starters coming back, and they rank number 130 on my experience chart. Now, there are strengths. I like the defense. Defensive line, I rate number 9 in the country. They've got good special teams. Quarterback play is a question coming in with Dylan McCaffrey Milton taking over for Patterson. But I like the running backs with Haskins, Charbonnet, and they actually go 5 deep at running back this year, which is an improvement over last year. 4 offensive linemen left for the NFL, though.
Yes.
That inexperience, I think, hurts them this year. I think the top 2 teams in the East are Ohio State and Penn State. And I believe the East comes down to that. I'm going to put Michigan a little bit of a distant third there.
Yeah, and Patterson could move around. He reminded me of a poor man's Johnny Manziel, and between his loss of mobility and the offensive line, I too think Michigan takes a brief step back. A fascinating program to me is Texas. I like Tom Herman. He is can be outspoken. He can be polarizing. He can be a little, I would say, precious or finicky with the media, so he doesn't build a lot of allies outside of Texas for him. I really like Sam Ehlinger. I think there's a Tebow quality to him. But I got to tell you, Phil, it feels like to me, and I would support him for, because I think it took Dabo Swinney years to win. I'd give Herman another 3 years at Texas. I've always thought it's a tougher job than people think. It's got a lot of heavy-handed boosters and regents. But do you believe this team this year, okay, let's say they don't beat Oklahoma. Could they win another 9 or 10, 8, 9 beyond that?
I like this Texas team this year. In fact, I'll take this year's Texas team about a touchdown favorite over last year's Texas team. Remember last year, Texas only had 8 returning starters coming back. And of the 3 returning starters they had on defense, their secondary got wiped out. Remember heading into the Oklahoma game, they were down like 4 DBs, which is not the situation you want to be. And yet they stood toe-to-toe with Oklahoma, only lost that game by a touchdown. They've been within a touchdown the last 6 regular season games against the Sooners. And now they have 16 returning starters. All those injuries they had in the secondary last year give them depth in the secondary. Now a lot of the guys started last year that weren't supposed to start. That gives them a lot of depth, 9 returning starters there, 7 on offense. And I like Sam Ehlinger. I mean, he's a tough guy. The team is completely behind him. He can hurt you running and passing. The running back core is deep. I like this year's Texas team. Would be, as mentioned, a touchdown favorite over last year's Texas team.
Phil Steele, his college football preview is out, only $19.99. Angles, trends, stats, returning starters. He's got recruiting stuff in there. It is my Bible. I used to buy 7 or 8 of these magazines. I now have 1. It's Phil Steele's college football preview, and I love bringing him in before our season. So I live in Los Angeles and have a lot of friends who are USC boosters. And when Bama and Notre Dame were knocked off their schedules, my USC friend said, oh, Lord, we're going to actually win the Pac-12 South because the 2 best coaches and 2 best rosters are out of it. And outside of Oregon, USC matches up very well. Clay Helton got a big break with schedules. I like USC's offense. I don't think they have a ton of depth on the defensive side, but what do you make of the Trojans this year?
You know, talk to almost every coach in the Pac-12 going through the rosters with them, and the 2 best rosters in the Pac-12 are clearly USC and Oregon. And I might even put USC's roster slightly ahead because of better depth on the offensive line and an improved quarterback. When you look at Keaton Slovis last year, remember they went through 3 quarterbacks last year. 2 of their road losses came in a first road start for a young quarterback. They lost to Notre Dame by 3. And they were so beat up defensively. If you look over their entire defense, find me a guy that started all 13 games last year. I don't think you can find one. So they had injuries there, injuries on the offensive line. Now they've got practically the whole team back. I think this is by far Clay Helton's best team. He's got 17 returning starters. I rate the quarterback unit. Slovis is up there. My number two set of receivers. I've got the defensive line and defensive backs actually in my top 20, Colin. So that's a little bit of a surprise after the way USC played defense last year. But once again, this is one of those teams where last year's injuries give them about 24, 25 guys with starting experience coming back, and that's going to be a big plus. I do think USC is the cream of the crop in the South, and I'm looking forward to a heck of a game in the Pac-12 title game with USC and Oregon, the two most talented rosters in the Pac-12.
Before I get to some SEC topics, Oregon has they have recruited very well. This is a tremendous recruiting staff. And there are staffs sometimes in college football, Phil. They're not great coaching staffs, the Ron Zook staff at Florida, but they're great recruiting staffs. Who's going to quarterback all these talented Oregon Duck players?
I think it's going to be Tyler Shough. Now, they did bring in a Boston College transfer in Anthony Brown, who has experience, and he's going to compete, but I believe it's Tyler Shough's team. He's 6'5". He's 229 pounds. He was one of the top 25 quarterbacks coming out of high school, and he's a guy that the team is behind. And as you mentioned, this is a talented team. And the difference is, Colin, you watch Oregon 10 years ago, they were a trick team, gimmicky, speed on offense. Mario Cristobal wants strength and power. And you look at this defense. That defensive front is actually one of the best in the country. I rate it number six, led by Thibodeau at defensive end, Jordan Scott at nose tackle. They've got Javon Holland back at nickelback. This is a very good Oregon defense with one of the best secondaries in the country this year. In fact, I rate it the best secondary. Now, the question mark I have, offensive line. They've got the best offensive lineman in the game in Penei Sewell, but they lose four starters. If they can get that offensive line reworked, and Mario Cristobal, offensive line coach, should be able to get that accomplished, and the new QB plays well, the rest of the talent is there for Oregon. And as mentioned, this is an Oregon team that I can get behind because they play defense and they play physical football.
Okay, I'm going to give you my dark horse national champion and my dark horse player of the year. So my dark horse national champion is Florida. Dan Mullen, they return a ton of players. I watched them. A Mullen's offense takes a year to kind of get everybody in sync. I think Florida's going to surprise people. I think they return a lot of starters. I like their young quarterback. That's my dark horse national championship team. Don't think they should be favored, but I think we could look up and they could be 8-0. Your thoughts on the Gators?
I think they're going to be the preseason favorite to win the East this year, looking around. And as you mentioned, Kyle Trask, how about the situation he stepped into last year? This guy hadn't even started a high school football game, steps into his first college start, does well, and actually had a 25-7 ratio. You got to think the improvement level this year is going to be huge. Defensively, it's a top-10 defense. Last year, they had one starter back on the offensive line. The offensive line's back intact. I think, Colin, to live up to your potential, they're going to have to run the football. There were games last year where Dan Mullen was unapologetic. We're not even going to try to run. We're just going to pass the football. And they only had 130 yards per game rush. I do think they will be able to run the ball better with the stronger offensive line and good stable of running backs. And if they get that accomplished, they could live up to your possibility.
Okay, before I give you my national championship game, the most unheralded great young player in football is Arizona State's quarterback, Jaden Daniels. I think he is a wizard. I think we don't watch Arizona State much. They play some of those late games. What do you make of his talent? What Herm Edwards, by the way, his staff, talk about recruiting has done a nice job.
Yeah, how about that pass he threw against Oregon when the Ducks were coming back late, and it's third and long, and he steps back and hits the long touchdown pass, and bye-bye Ducks, and bye-bye playoff chances.
Yep.
Yeah, I love Jaden Daniels, and you look at just two interceptions last year as a freshman, a true freshman coming in, and he was the guy I projected to win that job. He won. He's got all the talent in the world you want at the quarterback position. Got to put a little weight on. I'd like to see this guy get a little bit bigger, and I think he will this year. But he's got good receivers to throw to,
yes,
with Frank Darby and company. And, you know, I do like Jaden Daniels. I think he's an underrated QB.
Phil Steele, finally, let me give you my national championship prediction. Clemson against Ohio State. Ohio State, again, I don't know how many great defensive ends they can lose. Chase Young, the Bosas. And we all know the Trevor Lawrence story. Is just give me, in your opinion, because I imagine you have Clemson, Ohio State somewhere near the top. In fact, I think you have Ohio State number one. Give me the potential flaw for both Clemson and Ohio State, because we know they're loaded.
Yeah, my flaw, potential flaw for Clemson would be twofold. Number one, the offensive line is rebuilt. They only have one returning starter coming back on the O-line. And I'm a little concerned about the wide receiver depth since Justin Ross is out for the year. Those would be my two flaws that I have with Clemson. Now, they did a really good job developing the defensive line last year. Remember, they lost all those guys in the NFL, and they still had a really good D-line. If they can get that done on the offensive line, then Clemson's right there. And with Ohio State, the major flaw for them, I think, is at the running back spot. You know, Master Teague and J.K. Dobbins were a potent duo last year.
Yeah.
Teague tore his Achilles in the spring, very questionable for the fall. And they did bring in Trey Sermon from Oklahoma, but a depth at running back. You need some depth. And how about that 1-2 punch they had with Dobbins and Teague last year? I don't think this year's running backs can match that. So that would be the potential flaws with those two teams.
PhilSteele.com. Love talking to you. So we got the teams. We've got a dark horse national championship team. My two favorite teams, a player to watch, USC and Texas coaching positions. Michigan as well. Full plate of stuff to digest for the weekend. Phil, it's a pleasure talking to you.
You know, I miss chatting with you all these years, Colin. Good to be back on with you.
So we gave you our Phil Steele preview of college football to start, and now Chris Mannix, Sports Illustrated senior writer, has been in the NBA bubble in Orlando. Now, I'm just blown away by the aesthetics, the optics of the sport. But Chris is in the bubble. And Chris, first of all, great talking to you. The thing that's really blown me away is the intensity of the games. And I was talking to this about this to an NBA executive the other day. We were texting back and forth, and I said, you know, there's no travel. If the players look so fresh, it feels like March Madness. Have you been shocked by the intensity? These feel like playoff games so far.
Yeah, I mean, I've been surprised at how well some of these games have been played. I mean, they feel like playoff games in large part because for many of these teams, they almost are. I mean, for the six battling for that last spot in the West, it's a playoff game every single night. There's some jockeying going on in the East for seeding right now, especially in that kind of 3-8 range. So there's certainly a lot of intensity there. I think what surprised me the most is how well these teams have performed offensively so far.
Yes.
I thought coming in that the shooting percentages would crater. And in some cases they have. I mean, there are teams like the Lakers and others that haven't shot the ball well at all. But, you know, for the most part, the majority, the shooting numbers have been pretty high. And the offensive numbers have just exploded. You don't get too many great defensive performances here in the bubble. And I think while that hasn't, you know, it's not always the prettiest game, it does make it incredibly entertaining to see these types of numbers.
What was the consensus from other players about how Lou Williams handled his actions, the strip club? I've had a theory with the Clippers that Doc Rivers came into this thing knowing he had seeding didn't matter to him. He feels he has the deepest, best team. They were 11-1 in the 12 games. They had all their players. And that Doc Rivers, if he could find opportunities for players to, you know, if they had to go see family or something, you know, Doc's always been very player friendly. Now, whether that's right or not, the Lou Williams situation, were people disappointed? Were they laughing at it? Were they saying, I wish I was Lou Williams? I mean, what was the reaction, maybe, you know, off record from some of the players?
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. There wasn't a lot of sympathy for Lou Williams and the 10-day quarantine he had to go through when he came back. I mean, every player in this bubble would have killed to get one day off and go to a strip club and eat chicken wings and do whatever it was that Lou Williams did at Magic City. But, you know, this is the compromise they made with the NBA. They come back, they get their salaries, they get to compete for a championship, but the consequence is that you can't leave the bubble and you have to exist in an environment that's, you know, uncomfortable for you, that causes you to climb the walls inside this bubble. And Lou Williams, you know, had a legitimate reason for leaving the bubble, no question about that, but took advantage of it. And, you know, I think players, I mean, I don't think anybody was was frustrated with Lou Williams, they just weren't going to be siding with him on this particular issue. He tried to get away with something, and he couldn't. And, it was kind of a just punishment for a player doing something like that.
Three teams interest me. Let's start with the Celtics. I like them a lot, but they look small against Milwaukee. There are times I don't think they match up particularly well at times with Milwaukee. Toronto is a big, long team. As much as I like Boston and Brad Stevens, there are halves. There are moments I feel they look a little physically overwhelmed at times. Is that a fair criticism?
It's a very fair criticism. And, you know, the Celtics coming into this, this resume season, they had been a top defensive team most of the year. And that's been a hallmark of these Brad Stevens teams throughout his tenure in Boston. But they've been doing it this year with a lot of smoke and mirrors. They replaced Al Horford and Aaron Baines effectively with Daniel Theis and Enes Kanter. And Theis is a very good, versatile defender, off-ball defender. Kanter can defend the post, but not much else. So they had they replaced two elite defenders with two average or below average defenders. And they were able to succeed in the regular season. But when they start going up against these big physical playoff teams, and, you know, I watched them play against Milwaukee in that opener. I watched Steven Adams just destroy them in the exhibition season. When they go up against these big physical teams, they don't have a lot of answers. And it puts a ton of pressure on them offensively to shoot high percentages, to make threes, and to have these brilliant offensive games from Kemba Walker and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And because when they don't, you know, they're really vulnerable on the glass, and they're vulnerable to getting beat up by opponents in the half court. So it's going to be an ongoing concern for the Celtics. There's nobody on that roster that they can turn to. And Robert Williams had a good game this week in a matchup. They can go to him a little bit. He's been a starter for this team briefly before, but these players are not elite playoff performers. And so the Celtics, you know, they're going to have to really be this highly efficient offensive team to be successful.
The second team is Milwaukee. My statement will sound absurd when I say Chris Middleton could decide the fortunes of the next 5 years in the NBA. But if Chris Middleton struggles against the Toronto, and he has, they're very good defensively, and Giannis drops his 39, and they can't get to the finals because Chris is getting max money. It's not an attractive free agent market. They're not going to have a lot of salary cap space, right? It's coming down. That Milwaukee's a fascinating team to me. We know Giannis is superb, but if he doesn't feel he's got a two that can give him 24 against the best teams, you know, you get into that, how long do I want to be here? What do you make of Middleton, his value, his importance in the Bucks going forward in the bubble?
Well, it's enormous because he's clearly the number two option on that team. And look, he's responded this year by having a career best season. I mean, I voted for him for third team All-NBA guard, and his numbers certainly back that up. So there's a lot of pressure on him to have the type of season he had in the regular season, the playoffs, not just with making open shots, but, you know, being a guy that can take pressure off Giannis when he comes out of games, be the lead option in spurts offensively. So there's pressure there, but I kind of flip it a little bit, Colin, and say there's much more pressure on Eric Bledsoe. I mean, Eric Bledsoe hasn't shown up in a lot of these in the last two postseasons. He was decent this past year. 2 years ago, he was awful. The point guard position is stacked across the NBA, and it's stacked in the Eastern Conference, whether it's Kemba Walker in Boston, Kyle Lowry in Toronto. I mean, go down the list. There are good point guards you're going to face as you advance in the playoffs. And watching the Houston game against the Bucks, Bledsoe didn't play because he's still getting up to speed because of his COVID situation. But Russell Westbrook just destroyed Dante DiVincenzo and George Hill. You can't – if you're the Bucks, you can't succeed – if you're getting beat up on the point of attack as often as they were against Houston. That's on Bledsoe. Bledsoe is not only going to have to be efficient offensively, making three-point shots when they're there, but he's going to have to be a defensive stopper at that position. So a lot's on Middleton, sure, and he's going to get the attention of the number two guy, but, you know, Bledsoe, to me, is the ultimate wild card for the Bucks in this postseason.
Okay, I'm going to throw something I led my show with. This is, of course, Saturday, but on Thursday I led with this, is that we know the West is generally better than the East in the NBA. There's more stars, I think better GMs. But this year in the regular season, non-bubble, winning the West like the LA Lakers did is not as impressive at first glance. Why? Well, the Clippers had two new stars, had to work them into their system, and Paul George missed 22 games. Blazers didn't have Nurkic outside of the bubble, and Melo got acquired once the season had already started. Denver, Jokic was healthy, but many of the young players, other players, were not. Oklahoma City was a total rebuild. Dallas, Porzingis, Luka, great, both were hurt. So winning the West, coming into the bubble as the number one seed, it's not your typical West. It was deep, but there were injuries. D'Antoni, Westbrook and Harden get thrust together, and D'Antoni has an entirely different staff. But now in the bubble, all of those issues have settled. Houston staff, Westbrook and Harden, Nurkic is back. Oklahoma City now has played together. And now the Lakers actually have issues. No Rondo and Avery Bradley. The West is loaded. Teams like Portland, Houston are a nightmare if you're struggling at guards defensively. So my takeaway has been the Lakers took advantage, because LeBron and AD worked very well quickly. They took advantage of a regular season West that was in transition. But I feel like in the bubble, the Lakers now without Bradley and Rondo defensively have some transition, some perimeter guarding issues, and everybody else is more settled. So the Lakers aren't really as formidable a one as people think.
I think there's certainly some truth to that. I think that the Lakers' problems, well, you can throw the Bradley situation certainly at the top of the pile, because Bradley is the guy they're going to will need against these top flight guards, potentially beginning as early as the first round.
Yes,
which could be an absolute nightmare.
Yes.
For the Lakers if the Blazers wind up with that number one seed. What a story it would be for Carmelo to go up against LeBron. It may be his last chance to do anything substantial in his career, but that's neither here nor there. The Lakers, to me, one of their problems and questions coming into this postseason is one of the problems and questions you had beginning the regular season. That's, can they get enough shooting? I mean, you're not worried about LeBron and him coming around. You're not worried about Anthony Davis. These guys are going to be great in the playoffs. You are more concerned with Alex Caruso thrust into a bigger role. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope thrust into a bigger role. Danny Green needs to shoot the ball well, as he has in postseasons before, but there's as much pressure on him now as has been on him on any postseason run he's had in recent years. These guys, many of them, are not the most reliable three-point shooters and are unproven in the postseason. And if you can't make threes, you're giving defenses carte blanche to just load up on LeBron and load up on AD and dominate that way. I mean, you look at the potential conference finals matchup against the Clippers. If you've got Kawhi Leonard, who can defend LeBron James, and if you've got Montrezl Harrell and a couple other bigs that do a decent job defending Anthony Davis, you're going to put a lot of pressure on those Lakers shooters. So watching the Lakers early on, they haven't made a lot of shots, and that's given me some reason for pause as we come towards the postseason, that some of those early questions that we had about this team might be rearing their head once again.
When you're not covering games and when players aren't playing, golf, fish, pool, what are people doing in the bubble?
Well, a lot of them are in their rooms drinking wine. That's a big pastime here in the bubble. It really is. It's the major part of a player's day. Video games, as you might imagine, are huge here in the bubble, to the point where, you know, I was having this conversation with Eric Spoelstra. I was saying, do you almost feel like the parent of a teenager, where you're telling your players to get out of the room and go do something, like do something productive? And he said, yeah, we're not going to tell guys not to play video games. We encourage them to go play golf and go fishing and do stuff. But, you know, what I've noticed over the last week or so is that kind of the early novelties have worn off. Like early on, you saw all these videos on social media, the posts, like guys were fishing, first timers out there fishing. That, if you don't like fishing, that novelty wears off very quickly. Same thing with golf. I mean, There are some guys that love to golf. Chris Paul loves to golf. Jason Tatum in Boston loves to golf. But some of these guys don't golf at all and just tried it and now walked away from it. So there's been more, I would say, anxiety over the last week or so because guys have kind of run out of things to do. And what they're doing now is hanging in their rooms. One thing that's helped is that the NBA loosened their restrictions on teams moving between hotels. At the beginning, you couldn't visit other players in other hotels. Now you can, so that's allowed guys to have a little bit more social life with some other players. But it's kind of starting to devolve into players going to their rooms, going to their meal rooms. I mean, I sit most of the day, Colin, in the Coronado Springs lobby, and I can't tell you, like, I see the same guys trudging up and down the hallway all day long, going to the meal room, going back, going to the meal room, going back. Like, it's become a little bit monotonous for these guys, and unfortunately, I'm not sure how much that's going to change the next couple of weeks.
Chris, currently in the NBA bubble in Orlando. His name is Chris Mannix, Sports Illustrated senior writer. It is always a pleasure. I always thought of you in the bubble anyway, an intellectual bubble. You're very smart. So now you're just your bubble boy in Orlando, which, by the way, I spent a lot of time in Florida. Orlando in the summer is no treat, by the way.
Well, it's not, and it's funny. Like, we had to do the 7-day hard quarantine, and you know, everybody's in their room climbing the walls a little bit, anxious to get out. You get out, and I stepped outside and walked around for 15 minutes, and I said, screw this. I'm going back into my room. It was 90 degrees with 88 humidity. It felt like walking through soup. So it wasn't the most pleasant experience there. But I was born to do this type of experience. I'm not married. I don't have kids. What do I care? I mean, if they could just get Domino's to deliver to me, I'd probably be down here for the rest of the year.
Chris, great talking to you, buddy.
You got it, Colin.
Thank you so much for joining us for our Saturday podcast.